Good day. Today is Monday, 29th June 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Now, for much of the early part of this year, I have been speaking about the relative absence of Putin from the political scene in Russia in any matter that appeared to be directly connected to the conflict in Ukraine. After the attack on his residence in Valdai, Putin basically went to ground. He had one meeting in the Kremlin in January with Witkoff and Kushner, who brought with them a variant of the so-called 28-point plan that the United States was at one time working with. Putin met them, but one got the sense that he wasn't very impressed. And in fact, we've not heard anything more about that 28-point plan ever since. But anyway, that was in January. And even then, it was noticeable that Putin was saying less and less about Ukraine. And this continued for many weeks and months. He did speak to foreign ambassadors also in January. I said that the tone of his words and those of other Russian officials cumulatively suggested a hardening of Russian positions and a telephone conversation that Putin had with Trump directly after the drone attack on Putin's residence in Valdai in December 2025 suggested that the Russians were reconsidering some of the concessions that they had supposedly made at the Anchorage summit meeting and looked like they were about to withdraw those concessions. And then after this fairly brief flurry of activity in the last weeks of 2025, first weeks of 2026, Putin basically stopped talking about Ukraine. He became involved in various other issues. He remained as busy as ever in other respects. He focused on Iran, on domestic issues, on the state of the economy. He made a trip to China, but he didn't seem to be very engaged in issues relating to Ukraine. Now, that period of comparative silence from Putin ended about 2 months ago. But over the last 72 to 96 hours, we've gone from a period of relative silence earlier in the year to one of extraordinary, frenetic activity. Putin, over a relatively short time period, went from public meeting to public meeting discussing Ukrainian affairs. He gave an important and very interesting interview on Russian television through his favourite journalist, Pavel Zarubin. And, well, this briefly is a list of what he did. Firstly, he went to Valdai in Novgorod region, where he had a meeting with President Lukashenko of Belarus. Belarus, of course, has been the target of a cascade of threats from Zelensky over the last few weeks. I've discussed these in detail. At one point, Zelensky seemed to be giving Lukashenko a 7-day ultimatum, though in the event that didn't result in anything. Anyway, there has apparently been a telephone conversation between Lukashenko and Putin, though the details of that have never been published. Then there was the meeting in Valdai. The meeting continued for 2 days. the Russians have only published a very, very brief summary of the topics discussed, which include, importantly, the general security situation. It is overwhelmingly likely that Putin and Lukashenko discussed how to respond to Zelensky's threats to Belarus. We are likely to see over the next few weeks significant Russian military deployments to Belarus and probably weapons supplies by Russia to the Belarus military. But anyway, we have not been provided with much detail, any real detail, about this meeting, though its importance is shown by the fact that it lasted for the better part of 2 days. Then Putin returned to Moscow, where he addressed the election meeting of the United Russia Party. Russia's due to hold parliamentary elections in the autumn. He spoke about Russia being under unprecedented threat and pressure from the West, about the Western powers trying to orchestrate an information campaign against Russia in order to destabilize the internal situation inside Russia. He said that this campaign would fail. He said that the Russians are continuing to make big advances on the front lines. And I discussed this meeting of the United Russia Party, this meeting that Putin attended, of the United Russia Party in a previous program. And then Putin attended a further meeting, apparently on the same day, on the evening of the same day, in the Kremlin to discuss the energy situation in Russia. And I will return to that shortly. But over the course of that meeting, he also talked about the issues of Ukrainian drones and the steps that the Russians are going to take to respond to Ukrainian drone attacks. And then the Kremlin, Russian television, published this lengthy and very interesting interview that Putin gave on television to Pavel Zarubin. Now, it's not entirely clear when this interview took place, but Putin provided a detailed account of the military situation. And it's clear for me that this account of the military situation is right up to date, which suggests that the interview must have been given at some point over the last few days or even hours. So from meeting to meeting to meeting with Lukashenko, with the United Russia Party to discuss the situation in the energy system and air defense, and then follows up with this further meeting in which Putin discusses all sorts of things on Russian television and shares his thoughts about many questions with the Russian people. So, intense and very public activity. And the reason this activity is so public is because I think Putin has now finally understood that he was indeed in serious danger, serious risk of losing the information war that has been waged against him and against Russia in the Western media, to some extent amongst Western governments, and also, of course, by Ukraine and by Zelensky as well. There has been very, very orchestrated and well-organized campaign in the West to present a situation in the conflict, which, in my opinion, and as I've discussed in many places, actually sets reality upside down. It describes a situation where the Russian offensive is at a standstill, where the Ukrainians have regained the initiative on the battlefields, where they are regaining territory from the Russians. It talks about increasing economic stresses in Russia itself. It discusses a critical situation with energy supplies inside Russia caused by Ukrainian attacks on Russian refineries. It speaks of the situation in Crimea having become extremely dangerous, with Crimea practically isolated from the Russian mainland and critically short of fuel and electric power. And lastly, and unsurprisingly, there have been reports circulating all over the media in the West about the Russian elite losing confidence in Putin, of Putin's authority slipping. There's even been talk of a coup or moves to remove him being organised. There's been a great deal about a single video, or rather, no, actually it's more than one video, several videos published by a disgruntled soldier from somewhere, ex-soldier from somewhere in Russia, talking about how he was going to lead a march on the Kremlin. Rather strange episode, and rather unnervingly, it turns out that the man in question is now dead. But anyway, whatever. It gained an awful lot of publicity for a while. The video itself was heavily promoted by someone and went viral in Russia itself. And anyway, all of these rumours of coups, of plots, of a loss of confidence, of a decline in Putin's authority, were circulating. And it seems to me that Putin needed to make it clear that none of this, in fact, was true. And in fact, once he did that, as he did over the last 72 hours, my own sense is that he pricked the bubble of this information campaign, because, as he correctly pointed out, none of the individual parts that make up the information campaign are actually true. In fact, they stand the reality on its head. So, firstly, as he did in the meeting with the United Russia Party, he said that there was indeed an information campaign underway intended to destabilize the situation in Russia. He said it would not succeed. He said that the Russians hold the initiative on the front lines. He said that the reason the information campaign is underway is because the Russians are winning the war, and every other attempt to defeat them, either on the battlefield or by exerting economic pressure, has turned out to be wrong. So, has turned out to have failed. So, for that reason, Putin said that the West, the Ukrainians, have turned to the only thing that they have left, the one thing where they are more successful than the Russians, which is an organized information campaign. And much of this relates to the situation with energy, the drone attacks, and in particular the drone attacks on the refineries. So Putin, at the further meeting, the one to discuss the energy situation, wisely and correctly admitted that there have been attacks on refineries, that they have done damage. He was careful to say that the damage is quickly repaired, but he also very wisely did not attempt to downplay the fact that there'd been attacks and hits on refineries, and nor did he downplay the significance of the drone offensive as well. It would have been most unwise for him to have done that. The biggest mistake a politician can make is to deny the existence of a crisis which everybody believes in. What a wise politician does is say that, yes, problems do exist, not appear to downplay them, but then to reassure people that all the necessary steps to bring the crisis under control are being made, and that the crisis will indeed be brought under control very soon. My aunt, who was Minister of Culture in Greece, explained this to me many times. And of course, Putin himself is far too experienced a politician now, after having been in power for 27 years, to need that lesson. Anyway, so what he said was, yes, there's been these attacks on the refineries. Yes, the Ukrainians have conducted drone attacks on Russian cities. Yes, some of these drones have impacted on residential buildings. He was careful to describe the drone attacks as terrorist attacks. He was careful to say that the drone attacks do not in any way affect the realities on the front line, which he has discussed in detail in his meeting with Pavel Zarubin. And he also says that to the extent that there are problems in the fuel and energy system, they're not because of any shortage of fuel. The amount of petrol, of gasoline and diesel available is almost the same, exactly the same as last year. There is more than enough to satisfy all needs. What has happened is that in light of the information campaign and the drone attacks, some people have panicked and there's been panic buying. Putin's energy minister, Alexander Novak, talked about that. In some places, purchases of gasoline have gone up by 20 to 30%, and that obviously has caused stress in the general supply of gasoline and diesel. And then Putin said that because there is more than sufficient supply of all of these things, of gasoline and diesel, the necessary steps will be taken. He spoke about a committee that has been formed to ensure that they are taken. We already knew about the existence of this committee because Novak, the energy minister, in fact talked about this the previous day. And Putin predicted that by the first week of July, these problems, including the problems in Crimea itself, would have been resolved. Now, perhaps he's being over-optimistic about the situation in Crimea, where there are particular problems. About the situation in Russia as a whole, I am sure he's right. I am sure that the actions the Russian authorities will take to stabilize the fuel and energy situation at the pumps across Russia will indeed be effective. They might extend to caps on the amount of gasoline that people can pump their cars with at any one particular time. Anyway, that sort of thing. And of course, that is going to enhance his authority, because as my aunt also pointed out to me, when people see that the boss, the leader, is acknowledging the existence of the problem, and when he then says that steps are going to be taken to bring the problem under control, and when it appears to the population that those steps are succeeding and that the situation has indeed been brought under control, what of course they tend to do is attribute that to the authority and effectiveness of the boss himself, the country's leader. So it's actually a fairly effective way of enhancing one's popularity and authority. And clever leaders, which we don't have much of in the West anymore, truth to say, clever leaders historically have always known how to do it. So that's what Putin said about the situation in the Russian energy system. I would add that, of course, in the West, some of the media has taken some of his words and has distorted them in order to appear to confirm that there is indeed a crisis in the fuel and energy complex after all. But Putin is absolutely right not to let himself be over influenced or distracted from doing the politically correct and administratively wise things. As I said, at the end of it, he's going to come out the winner from this affair for the reasons I've just said. Anyway, that's one thing that Putin discussed. Then he gave this interview to Pavel Zarubin. And it is extremely interesting. Firstly, it's very interesting to see how the Kremlin has handled it. Firstly, the Kremlin provided what appeared to be a transcript of the interview. They published a transcript on the Kremlin's website, but it was only published in Russian and it was very incomplete. There were important things that Putin said, which I'll come to shortly, which are not in that transcript. So we got a very abridged version of the full interview. We do, however, have a film of it. And interestingly, the Kremlin decided that on the English language version of their website, they weren't going to provide a translation of Putin's words, the transcript of this interview at all. But anyway, here is what Putin said. Firstly, he again repeated, this is the third place he's done it over the course of just a few hours, that there is an information campaign intended to destabilize Russia, to discredit the military, and to sow doubt and discord about the situation within Russia itself. So he said that to Zarubin. He was then asked essentially to comment about Anchorage and about what is happening in the world of diplomacy. And this, of course, always today is the subject of enormous speculation. And it's probably fair to say that whilst Russian society in general remains relatively uninterested in the diplomacy, I mean, they don't follow the twists and turns of it in very great detail. The political elite across the country, and of course, many people in the military, take a great interest in it. And I think I'm probably right in saying that if we're talking about people who are connected with the military, they are very uneasy about any suggestion that diplomacy of any kind is taking place at all. They would rather that there was no diplomacy and that Putin and Russia focused exclusively on the war, the soldiers on the front lines, and the officers who command them would rather that it was that way than that they found themselves fighting and losing friends and putting their own lives on the line in a battle which might end at any moment in an unsatisfactory compromise. So there is that weight of opinion that Putin must think about in Russia as well. Others, however, in Russia, and as I discovered whilst I was in Pskov, not just elite Russians who want to go back to good relations with the West, but other Russians want some kind of dialogue, certainly with the United States, to continue. Because though overwhelmingly, as I discovered, they support the special military operation, they do not want to see Russia involved in a larger war, which they basically understand could only be against the United States. So Putin has to balance these various expectations and concerns. So Putin, over the course of this interview with Zarubin, commented first about the fact that there are no substantive negotiations taking place, and he essentially confirmed it, subject to certain things that we will talk about in a moment. He also, and this is one part of the interview which the Kremlin has not published or not provided a transcript of, a written transcript of, he also discussed what happened in Anchorage. Now, Marco Rubio, the US Secretary of State, has said that there was no actual agreement of any kind in Anchorage. No deal was done between the Americans and the Russians there. It's wrong to think that there was a deal. An offer was made, but it wasn't really accepted, and the meeting ended on that basis. Now, this, of course, contradicts what the Russians have been saying since the early autumn of 2025, and indeed since Putin's press conference, actually in Anchorage, directly after his meeting with Trump. Now, the Russian account is that Witkoff came to Moscow with a proposal from Trump. We've never seen this proposal. The Russians have never published it. The Russians, Putin, looked at the proposal and said, well, this does require us to make compromises, but we can work with this. Let's go forward with it. The Russians, which is to say Putin, then went to Anchorage. Putin, this is all according to the Russian account, mostly provided by the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. The Russians then said, Putin said to Trump and Witkoff, look, this is what I understand your proposal to be. And then Putin listed the items of the proposal. And then Putin said to Trump and Witkoff, have I understood this correctly? And then Trump and Witkoff nodded their heads and said yes. And then Putin said, to Trump and Witkoff. Are you able to guarantee that you can obtain Zelensky's compliance to the terms of this proposal that you are making to me? And again, according to Lavrov, Trump said emphatically yes. And then Putin said, well, in that case, despite the fact that we have to concede some things, we are prepared to accept this proposal. And that is the Russian account of what took place in Anchorage. And to say it very simply, offer and then acceptance, most people would say, lawyers certainly would say, that that is a complete agreement. But Rubio now says that there was, in fact, no agreement in Anchorage. And Putin is now saying the same. He says that things took place exactly as I've described, and as Lavrov has previously described. There was an offer made by Witkoff and made by Trump. After certain inquiries, Putin, the Russians, accepted this offer. But Putin now says that even though the offer, the American offer, was accepted by the Russians, there was no final agreement made. Now that is a shift in the Russian position. As I said, normally where there is offer and acceptance, one assumes the existence of an agreement. And that has been the Russian position up to now. But what Putin is now saying is that if the Americans are now denying the existence of an agreement, well, the Russians have no reason to go on pretending that an agreement was in fact ever reached. So what Putin told Zarubin is that what happened in Anchorage, in spite of everything working out as I've described, is that the Americans and the Russians were simply exploring possibilities with each other. Now, the relevance of this is that what it now means is that the Russians no longer consider themselves bound or committed to whatever concessions they agreed to make in Anchorage. Since there was no agreement between the Americans and the Russians can no longer be held to anything. Again, Putin is nothing if not an experienced politician, but he is also, and this again is something that people always overlook, a skilled lawyer. So what he's done is that he's taken Rubio's words and he's turned it round to his advantage. He says, fair enough, if you say that there was no agreement, there was no agreement. There was no agreement on our part conceding anything to you, because as you say, there was no agreement. So if there was, for example, a discussion about freezing the front lines in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions in return for the Ukrainians pulling out of Donbass, well, that is now over. It is dead and buried. It is gone. And then Putin did discuss various diplomatic proposals which have been made to the Russians over the last few weeks. And this is all very interesting because one does indeed wonder who is communicating these proposals exactly to the Russians. Are these proposals being communicated to the Russians by the Americans? How exactly? We've not seen any, there's been no reports of any meetings recently between American and Russian officials. If proposals are being communicated, are they then being communicated by email, for example? If it is the Americans, who are the people who are coming up with the proposals? Or could it be the Europeans or some people in Europe? President Costa, the president of the European Council, for example, he is known to have made some kind of outreach to the Russians over the last few weeks. He didn't apparently secure the full agreement of the European Council to do this. His outreach to the Russians was controversial with some European leaders, and Costa himself is admitting that all his overtures to the Russians received a rebuff. And that might be true if the two proposals that Putin mentioned did indeed originate with President Costa. One was for a ceasefire in the sky, for the Ukrainians to stop drone and missile attacks on Russia, in return for the Russians stopping Russian drone and missile attacks on Ukraine. There have in fact been multiple stories and rumours many times about discussions that have supposedly taken place between the Americans and the Russians, or between the Russians and the Ukrainians, for such a ceasefire in the sky. I remember that the first one was circulating in the early autumn of 2024, with suggestions that the Russians and the Ukrainians had come very close to agreeing to such a ceasefire in the sky, but that it all fell apart because of the Ukrainian offensive into Kursk region in August 2024. A lot of people have believed the story about such a ceasefire having been on the brink of being agreed, which made no sense to me, since it was obvious to me at the time that Russian missile and drone strikes on Ukraine were far more devastating than whatever it was that Ukraine was trying to do at that time. We're talking about the summer of 2024 with Russian refineries. But anyway, the US media picked up the story. It continued to be repeated in all sorts of places. There was reports in some parts of independent media about how Zelensky aborted a promising agreement for a ceasefire in the sky by his reckless decision to launch the offensive in Kursk. The fact that both the Ukrainians and the Russians denied that such a ceasefire had been agreed or was likely to be agreed didn't seem to register with most people. But anyway, that idea was out there then, and it has been repeated from time to time ever since. Donald Trump, in particular, pushed it very hard for a time in the spring of last year. Anyway, the Russians have always rejected the idea of a ceasefire in the sky, and Putin did so again in his interview with Pavel Zarubin. He said that such a ceasefire would only work to Ukraine's advantage because the Russian strikes on Ukraine were far more powerful and had far more effect and results than the Ukrainian strikes on Russia. The ceasefire in the sky would be lopsided and would disproportionately favour Ukraine. So Putin dismissed that idea out of hand. And then he mentioned another proposal that has also been floating around. And again, one does wonder who is coming up with these proposals. Anyway, the latest proposal, apparently, was for a ceasefire right across the entire conflict line in Kharkiv region, in Dnipro region, in Sumy region, in all of those places. Even as fighting in Donbass and Zaporozhye and Kherson region would continue unabated. And Putin's response to that is that this is a transparent device to provide time and space for the Ukrainian army, which is desperately short of manpower, having suffered terrible losses, to redeploy forces from all of the places where the ceasefire had been declared, in Kharkiv region, in Dnipropetrovsk region, in Sumy region, to redeploy them to fight the Russians in Donbass and in Zaporozhye and in Kherson. And again, he made it fairly clear that this ceasefire proposal was also unacceptable. So clearly, somebody is continuing to make proposals to the Russians, but clearly the Russians don't like any of the proposals that are being made to them. And Putin said that the Russians remain open to any suggestions that they receive, even if, like these two proposals, they are obviously unacceptable. But I found it very interesting that Putin himself did not set out any ceasefire proposals or war-ending proposals of his own. He didn't, for example, refer to Istanbul Plus, the set of proposals that he made when he spoke to the Russian Foreign Ministry on the 14th of June 2024. He basically said that the proposals the West was making were unacceptable, the proposals the Ukrainians are making are unacceptable, and the Russians will continue with a special military operation. And he spoke of the Russians liberating Donbass and also Novorossiya. And of course, as I have said previously, earlier in this program, and previously on many other programs, Putin has never clearly set out what the boundaries of Novorossiya are supposed to be. And these have changed in terms of Russian political rhetoric at various times. But strictly speaking, Novorossiya was a region of the former Russian Empire, and it included the entirety of Catherine the Great's conquests, which meant Crimea and the Black Sea coast of Ukraine. And of course, it included cities like Izmail, Nikolaev, and Odessa. And I have no reason to think that Putin does not mean that as well. So if he is talking about the liberation of Novorossiya, then it does rather suggest that he is thinking beyond the four regions. He is indeed thinking further about a potential Russian advance all the way to Odessa. And as I've said already, I suspect, I fully anticipate that once the fighting in Donbass is over, then Putin will set out his further demands in a further speech. But anyway, that's what Putin said over the course of his interview with Zarubin and over the course of his various meetings and discussions, that the West is trying to destabilize Russia, that diplomacy has ended and has failed. The Anchorage process is clearly dead and buried, that the Russians hold the initiative on the front lines, that the Europeans are not making coherent proposals, that the collective West continues to prepare for war against Russia, that all stories about energy crises in Russia, about the Russian army being on the back foot on the battlefronts is wrong, and that it is Russia that holds the advantage and will win the war, and that as important for winning the war is Russia's continued internal unity. And as I said in previous programs, this is an election year in Russia. There are parliamentary elections due in the autumn, and I expect this message to be repeated and rammed home to the Russian people continuously between now and then. That in this situation, when the West is trying to test Russia's internal unity, it is even more important than it has been in the past for Russians to stand together and to show unity in the face of this sort of crisis. And I think that Putin will get this unity that he seeks. In many programs, I have mentioned the American scholar, Gordon Hahn. Gordon Hahn has written extensively about Russia. He has discussed in many places how there is a kind of hardwiring in Russian society to close ranks when Russia feels itself to be under pressure of the kind that Putin is talking about. The drone attacks that are taking place against Russia, the missile strikes that are taking place against Russia, are exactly the kind of pressure that Putin is talking about and which Gordon Hahn has mentioned in his various articles. I suspect that we will see a further closing of the ranks within Russian society over the course of the next few months. Now, Putin did discuss other things. He did admit that there is a more serious problem with energy in Crimea. But again, he seemed confident that that problem would be resolved. And I am sure he is right. The recurring story of this conflict up to now is that the West repeatedly tries to create problems and crises for Russia in terms of sanctions and pressure on the economy, in terms of the war itself with the various Ukrainian offensives and all of those things. But whatever it is that the West and the Ukrainians throw at the Russians always find a solution to it and are always able to bring the situation under control. So Putin, when he says that the Russians will find a solution to the problems in Crimea, I am sure he's right. And I read an interesting article on a Substack site which pointed out that in fact Russia has all of the resources to ensure that Crimea remains fully supplied with energy and electric power, and I've no doubt that that indeed will happen. And on the drone offensive, the Ukrainian drone and missile offensive, Putin reiterated that it's a question ultimately of Russia's air defences. He spoke of the fact that there's been a major ramp up of production of air defences in Russia. He seemed confident that the increase in air defences across Russia would soon have an effect, and that the drone offensive itself would ebb away. And, well, there was another big night of Ukraine launching drone strikes at Russia last night. And again, the reports suggest that very few of the drones got through and that the damage they did was not very significant. So perhaps Putin is right and that the Russians are indeed as close to bringing the situation with Ukrainian drone attacks under control as he says. Anyway, that's what Putin said about all of these things. But he was careful again to reiterate that the main point of decision is going to be what happens on the battlefields itself. And here he gave his most detailed description of the situation on the battlefronts that I have ever seen him do. So he started with Donbass. He said that 96% of Konstantinovka is now under Russian control. I think that's probably roughly right. He gave the impression that apart from 150 buildings out of, I believe it was 11,000 in Liman, that the Russians control all of the buildings in Liman apart from 150, which would imply that Liman is about to pass under fully under Russian control and that there will be an announcement to this effect very soon. Anyway, that's what Putin said. He also spoke about further Russian advances on Slavyansk and Kramatorsk and of the Russians being very close to starting operations in these two cities. He said that fighting has already begun for capture of the village of Nikolaevka in east of Kramatorsk. And Nikolaevka is regarded by many people as a suburb of Kramatorsk, part of Kramatorsk itself. He said that the Ukrainians have spun many stories about Kupiansk, but that the Russians now are located 4.5 kilometers to the west of it, basically saying that Kupiansk is fully under Russian control. He said that in the area on the east bank of the Oskol River. Near the village of Barovaya, there's a Ukrainian force of around 5,000 men, which is on the brink of being encircled and placed in a cauldron, and that once that happens, and once this force is liquidated, as he put it, the Russians will be in complete control of the entire east bank of the Oskol River. He also spoke about Russian advances in Zaporozhye region. As I said, he gave a very, very detailed account overall about the state of the war. He said that he is not aware of the Ukrainians recapturing any territory from the Russians at all. He said that from time to time, the Ukrainians engage not so much in counterattacks, but in operations by special forces, penetrating deep into Russian-controlled territory. He accepted that things like that might happen in the future, but he seemed to discount the possibility that the Ukrainians, with their current manpower shortages, would be able to conduct a serious offensive in any particular location. And interestingly, on the topic of the city of Sumy, he said that the Russians are now 10 kilometers from the city of Sumy, that Russia has no political plans for Sumy. In other words, it's not for the moment saying that it wants Sumy to become part of Russia. But he very obviously left it to the military to make the decision whether the city of Sumy should be stormed, which leads me to think that a decision has already been made in Russia to storm the city of Sumy, just saying. And he also said that the Ukrainians still need to be punished for their incursion into Kursk and the various crimes which Putin says that the Ukrainians committed there. And I should say that I have seen a significant amount of information that does appear to corroborate the fact that crimes were committed by the Ukrainians there. And Patrick Lancaster is one of the people who has provided me with that information. He, of course, has been to Kursk, to these precise places, and he's seen the situation there for himself. So this is Putin. In effect, what we see is further evidence now of Putin the warlord. Putin determined to continue the war, probably looking beyond the four regions. In fact, I would say definitely looking beyond the four regions. He also, by the way, spoke about the fact that Zelensky's government could not survive a peace, which all but confirms to me that he does now plan or wish or intend for there to be regime change in Kiev. And Putin coming across as convinced that a military victory, which he clearly now sees as the only solution to the war, is within his and Russia's grasp, and that the only possible danger that exists is internal disunity within Russia that he is determined to prevent. So that overall is my sense of Vladimir Putin. There are certain other things to bear in mind. He said to the United Russia Party that the West is preparing for war with Russia. That clearly now is influencing his decisions. I really didn't get any sense that Putin believes anymore, not just that there will be a peace settlement in Ukraine, but that there's going to be any kind of rapprochement between Russia and the West. And it seems to me that to the extent that there is an internal debate underway in the Kremlin today, it is not about whether to seek negotiations to find a diplomatic resolution to the war. I think that is in the past. It is whether and by what means Russia can regain deterrence with respect to the West. Some hardliners, people like Professor Karaganov, believe that Russia must take strong action outside the scope of the war in Ukraine to terrify the West back into deterrence. There continues to be a school of thought within Russia, and I think it's the one to which Putin himself belongs, which believes that victory in the war in Ukraine and the reshaping of Ukraine to suit Russian interests, that will be a deterrent, that will be enough in and of itself to restore Russia's deterrent capability. That is the debate that is taking place in Russia today. And, well, from a Western point of view, it is a fairly bleak one. It means that the Russians no longer expect an improvement in their relations with the West in any proximate period of time. So, an unyielding Putin, focused exclusively on the war, confident that he is winning it, and determined to keep Russia united so that this victory, which is today in Russia's grasp, will not slip away. Well, I have to say, I think that Putin is absolutely right, that the Russians are indeed closer than many people realise to winning the war. I think once Donbass is captured, and especially if the Russians reach the Dnieper, which they will, and Zaporozhye City, which they also will, I think that people who say that if it's taken the Russians this long to get there, it's going to take them decades to occupy the rest of Ukraine, I think people who are talking in that way are talking nonsense, to say it simply. I think that if we reach that point, it will already be so clear that Ukraine has been physically defeated, that the prospect of Ukraine being able to continue organized resistance for much longer in the face of continued relentless Russian pressure is, frankly, I think, delusional. Which, of course, then brings me to the next point, because the West, at least the Europeans, continue to refuse to engage the Russians in any serious negotiations. The proposals that they've just communicated to the Russians for the ceasefire in the sky and the ceasefire in territories that lie outside the four regions are not serious proposals. The Finnish president, Alexander Stubb, continues to talk about Ukraine eventually joining NATO, all of those things. What European leaders are doing by talking in this way is that they are throwing away whatever remaining chance of peace between Russia and the West still exists. More likely, what we're going to see is a defeat of the West in Ukraine, which is going to be even more total than it looked, say, a year ago. And potentially the breaking of Ukraine as a viable independent state that might play a role in European in European politics. So I think that this whole narrative, Russia on the back foot, time to increase the pressure on the Russians, I think is going to achieve the exact opposite effect to what its advocates perhaps imagine. It's not going to make the Russians falter or make them wobble. It's going to make them tougher and close ranks even further. And it's going to lead for the West, ultimately, to an even greater defeat. Anyway, that's the situation as I see it today. We will see, I expect, over the next few weeks, further Russian breakthroughs in Donbass. According to what Putin said, Liman has all but fallen, Konstantinovka too. And that, of course, corresponds with my own assessment of the situation in these two places. The Battle of Kramatorsk is likely to begin very soon. I don't think the Ukrainians are in any position to withstand the Russians there for very long. And there's been further Russian breakthroughs over the last few hours and days in Dnipropetrovsk region. It looks like the town of Pokrovsky is close to encirclement and likely to fall. That will mean almost certainly that Ukraine will be forced to give up the village, the large village of Veliko-Mikhailovka, which actually lies to the west of Pokrovsky. If Pokrovsky is captured by the Russians, the supply lines into Orekhov from the north are cut. The Russians are already closing on Orekhov from the east and the west. The Russians are now systematically bombing the city of Zaporozhye as well. They've recently apparently attacked power lines supplying power to the city of Zaporozhye from the west bank of the Dnieper. The situation looks critical, and we see that Sirski, even as he admits that the Russian army that's fighting in Ukraine continues to grow in size, he also continues to demand that Ukraine conduct another mobilization, which appears to confirm that manpower shortages within the Ukrainian military are increasing. These narratives we spin for ourselves in the West, and we are so ready to believe. They don't make the situation for Ukraine or for the West better. They make it worse. But it seems that we can't give up on them, and that continues to be what we do. Well, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.